All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm talking to you from New York City on this, the 25th day of May, 2021. I do want to remind you that I write a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks, and that you can subscribe to that letter by going to miningstocks.com. You can call our office here in New York City at 718-457-1426, 718-457-1426 during normal work hours in New York City. I would also encourage you to consider subscribing to Chen Lin's letter, What is Chen Buying, What is Chen Selling? ChenPicks.com is the place to go for that. Chen has especially a strong track record in the biotech sectors, but he also has done very well in the mining and in the energy sectors as well. What is Chen buying? What is Chen selling? Go to chenpicks.com. And we also like to remind you to consider subscribing to Michael Oliver's letter at olivermsa.com. Michael will be with me in a few minutes from now to give us his latest ideas about the markets. And I want to thank all of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows on the Voice America Business Channel. And also want to encourage you to continue sending along whatever comments you might have about this show, good or bad or indifferent or whatever. Send away whatever your thoughts are about our show. Let us know. Want to thank our sponsors, this week's sponsors that make this show viable, economically possible: Novo Resources, Sitka Gold Corp, El Oro Resources, Irving Resources, Hannon Metals, Firefox Gold, Lion One Metals, SK Mining Corp. And I should say that I remain extremely bullish on the prospects for all of our sponsors in 2021 as they are all gearing up for the exploration program this summer and going into the fall as well in many cases. Last week was the Metals Investor Forum, and I gave my presentation, a 20-minute presentation, which you can now view. It's a video, a YouTube video. If you go to miningstocks.com, scroll down to the second half of the homepage, and you'll see today's date, 5/25, a link that will take you right to my presentation in which I talk about the parallels between the Mississippi bubble of 1720 and how disastrous that turned out to be. We're in my view, very much in the same predicament as John Law was with the Mississippi bubble, only on a much grander scale, I fear. Anyway, you can watch that 20-minute presentation if you care to. Go to miningstocks.com. Scroll down to the bottom half of the page, second half of the page, important economic headings, and you'll see on May 25th a link that will take you to my talk concerning the United States compared to the Mississippi bubble. I also invited some companies that I really think you need to keep an eye on for this year as the exploration season gets underway: Goliath Resources, Firefox Gold, Gold Source Mines, White Rock Minerals, and Newfound Gold, one of the hottest stocks on the planet right now, Newfound Gold. They will be making presentations, and I'll keep you posted as to when they're available to watch those presentations. I've titled today's show, Is America Facing Stagflation? Lynn Alden and Michael Oliver return. We will be talking to Michael in just a couple of minutes from now. The last time we spoke to him, he was pretty much seeing an equity market weakness, but didn't see a crash. He saw sort of a layered decline. He also thought that at least in the near term, we would see both gold and the treasury markets benefiting from that. But of course, we're seeing much higher inflation rates now. Is it possible that we might see a decline in the equity in the bond markets, along with an equity market decline, as inflation has reared its ugly head for the first time in many years, to something like an annual rate of something over 4%? Well, it's certainly more than the Fed has been bargaining for. We'll see if it's a transitory issue or not. Certainly one of the things we're going to want to talk to Lynn Alden about as well today. So we do have an inflation problem. We'll see if that's going to have something to do with the issues. Next week, we're going to be talking to David Rosenberg. David is more of a deflationist or a disinflationist. And, of course, a couple of weeks ago, we had John. Had our in John Williams with us, who is of the hyperinflation school. So there's various ideas out there. So we want to talk to, we do really want to talk to Lynn Alden in the second half of today's show to see what she has to talk about. Now, I was reading some of her latest writings in preparation for today's talk, and she's really looking at the possibilities of the 70s, not so much the 1970s stagflation, which seems like a real possibility in my view, having lived through that time. It feels a lot like that to me. But she has some very good arguments for comparing the current period that we're in now with that of the 1940s. I think very well reasoned, ideas as to why we may be looking at something much more like the 1940s inflationary situation, where the federal government has to spend huge amounts of money to get things going again. Fiscal stimulus rather than monetary stimulus, as she points out, it is very difficult when these long credit cycles, long debt cycles near the end, it's very difficult for monetary policy to have any effect, any significant effect, and the only thing left is fiscal stimulus. So we'll talk to Lynn Alden in the second half of today's show to see what she has to say, and her explanation should be very, very interesting. I'm really looking forward to that. In the meantime, right now, though, we're going to take a commercial break. And when we come back, Michael Oliver will be with us to give us some of his ideas about what he sees right now in the markets. Certainly turning bearish, I think, on equities. Turning bearish on the dollar from what I've seen in his most recent remarks. So we'll ask Michael to comment on those key markets when we come back. So we're going to go to commercial break now. But don't go away. We'll be right back with Michael Oliver.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
Firefox Gold is actively exploring in Finland, where recent discoveries have sparked a new gold rush. Firefox controls a major portion of a prospective gold belt, giving the company a distinct advantage for exploration and strategic partnerships. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, will put Firefox on the crest of the coming wave of gold discoveries. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me Michael Oliver once again. It's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com, to sign up for Michael's excellent work. And he provides a couple of different options for you to subscribe to. The weekly report is a main report that he puts out, but he puts out reports during the week when there are very significant changes in the market. They're very timely reports that he puts out. And then there's a gold and silver report as well, which is excellent. They're all great, and they're all have been very, very helpful to me over the last number of years. So thank you again, Michael, for coming on with us today. It's really always good to have you here. I want to ask you, in your headline last week on the weekend 360 report, you said U.S. stocks, the situation ripens. What do you mean by ripens?
Well, technically, we think they're in the process of topping. One of the key factors in defining a top is when your leadership fails. And not necessarily so obvious on price charts, but on a relative performance basis, if you go back and look at major tops in the stock market, let's say the 2000.com top, the NASDAQ 100, which reflected that leadership back then, began to drop in price, not drastically, but while the S&P didn't so much. In other words, it, relative performance basis, it started to collapse. In fact, if you just plot a spread between the one and the other, NASDAQ and the S&P, you see that the leadership, which had been the dot-com, the Internet, so forth, was relatively collapsing to the broad market. So the broad market kept saying, oh, gee, we're fine. In fact, that occurred, by the way, in the first and second quarter of 2000. And by August of 2000, S&P was back up near its highs, ignoring the loss of leadership. Mm-hmm. The same thing occurred in 2006 and 7. When your leadership then had been financials and home builders, especially. Mm-hmm. They collapsed in relative performance and actually started down in net trend well before the market topped. But the market said, no, we don't care about that. You know. And Bernanke mm-hmm. reassured, he says, there's no housing bubble. Okay. Well, there was, and the leadership warned you ahead of time that, okay, your leadership's gone. And it's not a simple matter of rotating to some other little sector to say, make up the difference and, oh, okay, a new leader. That doesn't happen. Well, this time around, we had a real explosion in the tech sector, particularly, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Last summer, vertical price action, much more so than the S&P. So your leadership was very strong. But since then, the spread between the NASDAQ and the S&P has virtually collapsed. And it shows up in the not so much on the price charts, but in the difference between the two when you measure them. Now, some people have noticed that, but they've said, oh, it doesn't matter. You know, again, the same story. There's other sectors doing well. Financials are doing well mm-hmm. now and so forth and so on. We think they're denying reality. Now, when we look at the technicals of the S&P, the broad market, it is dancing, literally dancing on what we consider our first sell triggers. Yet last week and the prior week traded down to our sell numbers, didn't close the week below them, and then rallied. Like, ooh, you know, it knew something was there. We use the word inevitable in our weekend report. We think now that structure's been set, it's just a matter of which week in the next probably 3 or 4 weeks does the S&P finally break that, in which case you start to get your net trend downside. And, of course, anybody in other markets has to then say, well, what does that mean for the T-bonds? For
example, right, exactly. Debt. My next question, yeah.
Well, you know, interest rates have been rising. Bonds have been selling off. In fact, bonds, T-bond futures, made their highest monthly close, I think it was July and then August. Oh, coincident with gold. mm-hmm. And they both declined, T-bonds more so than gold. But T-bonds are now set technically for a very sharp rally, meaning a drop in rates. Now, why would you have a drop in rates if you have commodity price inflation, which is pretty much accepted now, finally, that we do have that? Because there's an asset manager flow of capital, of those managers who doubt the sustainability and viability of the stock market at this point. And when mm-hmm. they have that doubt, where do they move their money? Well, mm-hmm. they tend to move it into government bonds, especially long end, and they tend to move it into gold. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're seeing now is the T-bonds are starting to catch up to gold's upturn. And those two markets turning up is an indication that the stock market's probably about to turn down. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think there's going to be a stock market crash. I think we had that in March last year. I think if you start a bear market now in stocks, it's going to be more of a layered type event. Like most stock market tops, in fact, aren't crashes. The 2000 top wasn't. It went down in layers. The 2007-2008 bear market only got crash effect at the tail end of the market. So I think if we top now in stocks, it's not some drastic overnight, you know, they pull the rug out from under it. It's more of a confusing downturn. Which, you know, in other words, every time you drop and it goes back up a bit, the longs say, oh, it was a bargain. So it fools them all along the way. Meanwhile, watch gold and T-bonds. But T-bonds right now, I think, are very important. They're starting to break out. And if they break out on our momentum technicals, I think it's reaffirming gold at the present time. Because T-bonds are in sync with gold at the present time. I think that linkage between T-bond price direction and gold price direction will change. But I don't think it's going to change now. I think for the next couple quarters, it's probably still going to be in sync. At some point, we're going to have the event where T-bonds go down, meaning rates really go up because of the inflation. And gold continues upside, whereas T-bonds go down. But we're not there yet. But anyway, the real big event right now is something very few people are looking at.
The dollar.
Yep, and the euro. The euro is more than 57% of the dollar index is weighting. So watch the euro. Our very long-term momentum work turned positive on the euro and negative on the dollar back in early 2017. And at that point forward, basically, the price level at which momentum said, okay, euro is now going to go up, dollar down, basically they never really got much back below those levels in the euro or back above them in the dollar. But they didn't collapse either. Dollar didn't collapse. It just went down about 10% 2018, rallied back up to about where our sell level was last year, and then collapsed again back to the bottom end of its multi-year range. And if you look at a price chart now, I think the key is price. Momentum already says dollar's no good, euro's going to be better. Okay, but price charts are very clear. If you look at a scroll up a monthly price chart of the euro futures, if you want, and the dollar index, go back to at least 2010 or something like that, you'll see there's a line on both charts that defines for the euro what had been a floor, now a ceiling. And if you're approaching the ceiling again, if you break through about 123 on the euro, right now it's been the 122s, I think it's going to start to launch because the price guys are going to get excited. Reverse that for the dollar. The dollar has a pivotal level at about 89, dollar index. We're now 89.60. You touch 89 again, and I don't think they're going to be able to, I think it's going to start to whoosh. In other words, these two quiet markets, the major foreign exchange markets, which have not been volatile on a percentage basis for at least 5 or 6 years, are suddenly going to get noisy. And I think that's going to have wave effects on a lot of assets and be a second, a seconding of the gold upside, the weak dollar. We'll be saying, yep, okay, you knew all along I was going down. You didn't wait for me. I think we're at that point.
Well, if the dollar gets weak, then that, you know, as you say, it might ding gold higher, silver, I would think commodities in general, right?
It'll help
And then you're going to have, again, more inflationary concerns, which is going to put pressure on the Fed to continue to print more money to try to hold interest rates down. Michael, do you see, you and I are old enough to remember, I think you're old enough to remember the 1970s. I'm a few years older than you, but we remember the Fed got behind the curve. They continued to, you know, rates, inflation kept going up. The Fed would allow rates. Rates were going up, whether the Fed allowed them or not. Rates were rising. They left them rise. They tried to tamper. They tried to keep them from going nuts. But they were always behind. The rates weren't rising as fast as inflation until Volcker came in finally and slammed the brakes on, you know, put the brakes on. And I don't think they can do that again at this point in time, any time like they could then. But do you see sort of a stagflation situation like that? Because we had this high levels of unemployment. The Fed, you know, was behind the curve in the sense of getting inflation under control. Do you think it's possible it might get away from these guys? Inflation might get away from them.
I think it already is. And I think that when you hear the concern by investors that, oh, the Fed might taper, so gold sells off that day. You know, it was last week or something.
Yeah.
Powell said something. And that is silliness, because the one factor that you got to pay attention to if you're in gold is the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one asset category that has not hurt the Fed, that has not been something they've had to put a fire out, has been the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since the March low last year, which was a very brief collapse, very deep, it's been going up, 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 up. So it's not been a factor that's caused them to keep a loose monetary policy. Other things have. But that one has not been a problem for them. What if it suddenly becomes a problem?
Mm-hmm.
What if it suddenly starts down and, you know, the 6 months we find the S&P is, oh, it's down 20% off its highs. No, not collapsing, but, you know, uh-oh, because it's a psychological thing. And Bernanke wrote a paper on this. I keep citing this in many interviews. In 2003, he wrote a paper on why the Fed needs to defend the stock market, primarily for psychological reasons, to keep people spending money rather than saving money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he was explicit in his argument. And, well, if the stock market becomes a negative now, that's suddenly going to talk of Fed tapering is just gone. And plus, you'll have more fiscal policies as well. Because psychologically, even if you're not the one percenter in the stock market, you're employed by a company and you see its stock go down, you've been around long enough to know, uh-oh, I might get laid off.
Yeah, exactly.
So it scares you, too.
Right.
So they have to defend their monetary policy and keep it ongoing if that stock market wobbles, and I think it's about to.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is psychological, but there's also a real reality to a declining stock market too, Michael, in the sense that pension funds and other fund managers have had to go out on the risk curve, you know, because they're not getting any interest rates. So now what are you going to do if you got pension fund obligations and the stock market goes down 20%? And you have an aging population now that's going to demand you know, their pension funds. So this is another issue, I think. And then we come along and, you know, all of a sudden, Mr. Biden pumps $6 trillion into the system with fiscal stimulus that has to be printed. And there's nobody around the world that wants to buy treasuries anymore at these rates anyway. No more foreign money coming in.
The dollar's also degrading the treasury.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay. The dollar, they'll get a double whammy. The dollar goes down, and their treasury dollar value of the treasuries go down, a double whammy. So it's hard to see, you know, what asset classes eventually will end up other than gold, silver, maybe tangibles, you know, commodities in general. Although if you have such an inflationary problem globally that it really stops commerce from taking place, I don't know how bullish that is for commodities in the short run either. But that's another story. What are you looking at then? Gold looks. I see we're knocking on the door of 1900 now today.
Oh, how's it look? You traded over 1900 today, so it's interesting. It took 8 months to go from 2050 high close down to the 1670s, and it took you about 8 weeks to get back over 1900.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, surprise. We think that in that asset category, the gold component of the commodity category, that silver is a better place to be.
Mm-hmm.
This is a technical assessment, long term, and the miners are a better place to be than gold itself. Now, gold is the mama, so you got to watch gold. But as gold goes up, those two other, the silver and the gold and silver miners should outperform gold, and that's a better place to be, in our view. With the Bitcoin collapse, which by the way we nailed pretty well back in April. When it dropped to 59,000, it was about $6,000 off its high. We said, there could be a sharp drop into the 30,000 zone. And sure enough, it not only got in the upper 30,000s, but the lower 30,000s very rapidly, more quickly than we even thought. We think that as a, quote, alternative, especially among younger people, is now been dished. And I don't think Bitcoin, even when it does turn and have a nice rally, and it's in an area now where it might build a base and turn up for another rally, it's not going to resume its bull trend. It's going to have to do a lot of work to do that. I'm not arguing that Bitcoin's going to collapse like it did in 2018 when it went from, you know, 20,000 to 3,600. But I think it's wounded psychologically and technically. And I think it's going to be a hard time for it to resume what had been going on, you know, between 2020 and 2021, which was off the page. I think if there's a new Bitcoin out there, it's going to be silver.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Where you get that kind of geometric rise, where you go from, you know, 20-something, $29 silver, and suddenly you're at 50, and then suddenly you're beyond those dual highs at 50. And well, I think silver is the one to watch, is the new Bitcoin.
Well, it's the common folks' gold, or the common folks' money, I guess you'd say. Michael, people hear you talk on this show all the time about the big markets, you know, the equity markets, the T-bonds, and the dollar, and so forth. But you also, what people aren't as aware of, is that you also cover all kinds of other markets. And one I want to ask you about, with a couple of minutes left here, is uranium market. The uranium market. Uranium has started to rise, and you have provided some charts on uranium. What's your thoughts on uranium at this time?
Well, uranium, we turned bullish a couple years ago, in fact. It got very depressed, like most commodities, and it was behaving like commodities. In other words, as the commodity cycle peaked in 2011, most commodities went down from there. So did uranium. It collapsed from like 70 bucks down into the teens. It turned up, and a couple of years ago we turned bullish, and it's gained ground since then, $10 or $15 since the upturn. And our last report, it was about 29. Now it's 31. The real key on uranium, first off, there's no liquid way to trade it. The futures do produce prices on the CME, but it's really not liquid. So we keep track that way, just of the uranium price and its momentum, which is positive. But the main thing is to be in the uranium. Uranium producing companies like CCJ, Cameco. There's also an ETF called URA, which covers a lot of uranium producers, including CCJ, which are vastly outpacing uranium. And this is true in the commodity category in general. In other words, rather than saying buy soybeans, we were bullish at $9.30. It's now up to with 16 or so. Instead of suggesting to buy beans, corn, wheat, sugar, etc., we suggested buying fertilizer stocks because they were equally depressed and correlated to the grains, meaning if grains turned up, these guys would turn up. And percent-wise, they've done a lot better. Same is true with the uranium stocks. So the better place to be is not the commodity itself necessarily, but stocks that have been depressed along with the commodities and are turning up, because they tend to go up a lot more on a percent basis. I think it's in part due to not just that they were depressed like commodities, but a lot of asset managers just don't buy corn futures.
Right. You know? Of course.
They buy things that are related to the grain markets and fertilizer stocks and farmland. There's even some ETFs on farmland. They've done quite well. Where farm acreage has exploded. So it's the stocks, as I said, with the gold situation, don't buy gold, buy gold miners, or especially silver miners. I think that's the better place to be and for the next several years.
Well, I agree with you, and because of the leverage factor too, and when the metals go up a bit, and they're in the money, all of a sudden the profits of these miners can go up very dramatically. And the senior gold miners I saw just recently are doing better than they ever have, and I think we're just starting to see the big move.
It's all time highs again. You know,
it is, and the profits are really strong. The free cash flow is just amazing among the big.
I wouldn't be shocked
miners.
By a lot of these little teeny miners. The little, you know,
they're the ones that are
assembled miners get bought up.
Absolutely, those are of course the ones that I follow in my newsletter. And I might just add, Michael, there is a small phosphate mine that's moving towards production in Quebec that looks like a huge winner for me, and it's one that I cover called Ariane Phosphate, and it's one that I cover in my letter. It wouldn't be one that you would have enough data yet, probably, to make a good chart, but it's one that I've got my eyes on. And certainly you mentioned fertilizer. I think you're absolutely right about that. The world has to eat. People have to eat. That's one thing. It's not going to go out of fashion. So, all right. Thank you so much, Michael, for your generous sharing of your time today. And we're always grateful to you for coming on and helping our listeners. It's great to have you.
Thank you much, Jay. Thank you.
All righty. All righty, folks. We do have to take a break now, but don't go away because Lynn Alden will be with me. And we're going to want to hear what she has to say, how she's actually comparing the 1940s with our current situation more so than the 1970s. So we'll look forward to what Lynn has to say right when we come back. Don't go away.
follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa, play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have with me once again Lynn Alden. And I should mention the website to go to for Lynn Alden's work and to subscribe to her service is simply lynnalden.com, lynalden.com. She has been really quite a rising star, I would say. I see her more and more in various interviews on the internet and various places. And there's a reason for that, because she's been very very astute and very accurate about the way she views things. And I think applying her engineering skills sort of gets under the hood and understands sort of diagnoses and sort of explains what is going on and why things are happening in the way they are. It's always good to have that understanding as well. Thanks for joining me again, Lynn. So good to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Glad to be here.
It's really good to have you. We've titled today's show, Is America Facing Stagflation Like That of the 70s? Sort of what I feel as one who lived through that period of time. But when I read your article this morning titled Fiscal Driven Inflation from your May newsletter, I think I really had to accept your argument that what we're going through now looks more like the 1940s for various reasons. And I want to get into that maybe right away. But maybe you can talk about the characteristics of the long debt cycle first, though, because that's sort of the structure that you're looking at. We have these long periods of, 70 or 80 years, perhaps, these long cycles. And as we go through the cycle, it changes. Well, I'll let you tell the story. The long debt cycle, and you talked about Ray Dalio first sort of popularized this idea, but talk to us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was a concept popularized by Ray Dalio, of Bridgewater fame over the past decade, and it's something that I've incorporated into my analysis that I've kind of done a lot of independent analysis on. And basically what the idea there is that, you have the normal credit cycle, the 5 to 10 year credit cycle. But normally what happens is that, when you have a deleveraging event, you don't end up deleveraging all the way back down to the starting point as a percentage of GDP. Mm-hmm. And so, basically policymakers come in, they do stimulus, they cut interest rates. And so what you have over the course of multiple decades is you have multiple credit cycles, and each time you end up with higher and higher debt as a percentage of GDP, and you end up with lower and lower interest rates as a percentage of GDP. And that starts to come to a head when you get down to zero interest rates and very, very high debt levels. And so if you look at, multiple long-term charts, like I presented in that article, in many ways, the current environment looks a lot like the 1940s, and the past decade looks a lot like the 1930s in terms of where we stand in terms of the private debt bubble and the public debt bubble. And so in that sort of cycle that we're facing now, basically the release valve ends up being the currency. And so what they do is they generally do more fiscal stimulus. They have higher inflation levels while still holding rates at, near zero levels. And so if you're holding cash or bonds, you end up, losing over the course of that decade in terms of purchasing power. And so for multiple reasons, I'm finding a lot of parallels between the 1930s and 40s compared to the 2010s and the 2020s.
Mm-hmm. And as the cycle matures, as you say, the rates keep getting lower, but the debt to GDP keeps rising. The central bankers seem to be in control to a great extent, but they can't allow interest rates to rise too much. Is that the reason rates keep getting lower? Because the debt burden is so great, the system can't take it, and so they have to keep shoveling more money into the system to try to keep the rates from rising? Is that what's going on?
That's one of the big factors, yes. And it's also, we're seeing a transformation of private sector debt into public sector debt. And so a really good example of that was Japan. Over the past 20 years or so, you saw a significant amount of private sector debt get deleveraged while the public sector leveraged up. And so we're seeing that more and more in the United States and Europe as well, where private sector debt is being kind of transformed through fiscal policy and through other policies into more and more, you know, debt that's directly on the federal balance sheet. And you saw that back in the 30s and 40s, and we're seeing it again play out now. And that is one of the key differences between the 40s and the 70s, in the sense that in the 40s, when they were dealing with, you know, they're fighting World War II, they're doing all this fiscal stimulus in a sense, and yet they could not, you know, no matter how high inflation got, they could not let yields rise because that would render, you know, the fiscal situation insolvent. Whereas the 70s, because you had low federal debt and low private debt as a percentage of GDP, Volcker was able to raise interest rates in order to combat inflation. And so basically most metrics look more like the 40s than the 70s in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as we get towards the end, then it's just not possible to, because I remember vividly, I mean, I'm probably twice your age, Lynn, and I our first mortgage was a 17.5% mortgage when Mr. Volcker was able to raise interest rates. I don't know what the Fed funds rate were, but they were lower than that, but they were double digits. We had double digit inflation. I can't imagine. I mean, where do you think the breaking point is now? It seems like the equity market may be struggling a little bit now, what do we have on the 10-year? 2.7 or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And growth stocks are more vulnerable than value stocks. And so, for example, bank stocks prefer those higher yields, whereas those really, really high multiple growth stocks, especially the younger kind of unprofitable growth stocks, they're very sensitive to higher interest rates, at least in terms of their valuation. And so, you know, as the interest rate, if for example, a 10-year goes above 2.5, 3%, that starts causing significant pain points for the broader stock market, especially centered on those more growth oriented names.
As this debt cycle matures, or as it get, you know, from its start in through the life of it, it seems as though we have this massive, especially towards the end, massive redistribution of wealth. I've seen that. I think from 2008 or so, the Fed the deposits have grown very dramatically, but the loans have not kept up with that. And so we're seeing money not getting into Main Street through the lending process. As you point out, I think in your article you said in 2008 we sort of saw the height in terms of public, that is private debt. So why does this happen? I mean, we have this redistribution of wealth that has become really very pronounced in recent years. Why does this happen? Why are banks no longer lending out to the private sector? Is it because the private sector is becoming insolvent or less prosperous, or what? Why do you think that is?
Well, there's a few reasons for that. One, basically, there's a mismatch between the people that demand loans versus the types of loans that the banks want to make. And so, for example, the types of people that the banks would prefer to loan to, people with, you know, very high credit scores,
sure,
and that are very, you know, strong financially, they don't have a large demand for loans at the current time. They're doing pretty well. On the other hand, there are a lot of risky businesses that they would prefer to get loans, and banks don't have a very large incentive to lend to them with interest rates this low. Because they take on credit risk and all sorts of things like that. And so basically there's partially a mismatch. And this, again, is, you know, the last time we saw this magnitude of banks really not lending out a large portion of their deposits was back in the 40s. And so one of the key differences between the 70s and the 40s in terms of, you know, those are the past two inflationary decades of the past century. And, you know, we often think of the 70s as inflationary because that was a more recent one. But, you know, the 70s were a very loan-driven type of inflation. Mm-hmm. And so bank lending was growing very rapidly. You also had a rising fiscal deficit that supported that. But, a significant part of it was very loan-driven inflation. Mm-hmm. And then, of mm-hmm. course, you had commodity shortages, especially oil shortages from abroad. And so the difference is that the 40s, you know, it wasn't really driven by bank lending. It was driven by basically fiscal stimulus. Mm-hmm. And so basically what happened was the banks end up buying large portions of those treasuries. And so banks are indirectly lending, but it's through the federal channel. And so, for example, you had very fiscal-driven inflation. And that you know, what makes that different is that it can spike up very, very high, and then it can go away very quickly if the federal government, you know, stops running those deficits. And so in the 40s, you saw these, you know, basically you had inflation go as high as 20% and then literally disappear the next year and kind of stop going up. And mm-hmm. then you had, you know, another year later, you'd have it spike up to like, you know, 12% and then go back down to like 2%. And so that kind of weird off or on inflation is more driven by fiscal, you know, kind of the fiscal direction. Whereas it's not, you know, the 70s was a smoother type of inflation because that was more bank loan driven and kind of more from the private sector side. And mm-hmm. so basically what we're seeing now is that because things are very fiscally driven, there's not a lot of lending happening in the economy. And mm-hmm. so banks are basically stuffed full of treasuries and reserves rather than making a lot of private sector loans.
Right. So, I mean, I think your answer to my question is, in fact, the large majority of people, the mismatch that you talked about, the people that are not credit worthy but need the money. So we've had a drain from the middle class that's taken place during this cycle. Maybe you could argue the same thing happened in the 1920s, back in the days of the robber barons and so forth. But I wonder to what extent this redistribution of income from the middle class to the top 1% or 10% or 5%, whatever you want to break it down, to what extent that is playing out in this political populism that we're seeing, not only in the United States, but in other places in Western Europe and places like that.
No, I think those variables are very much connected. And so, you know, again, that there's similarities going back, you know, to the 20s, 30s, and 40s, where you had very high wealth concentration, and then, you know, you got rising populism out of that, and then that resulted in more redistributive type of policies. And so we're seeing a similar event now. We have, in many ways, very, very high wealth concentration. And over the course of the past decade, we're seeing more and more kind of pushback against that. And so I often conceptualize as a big pendulum that swings back and forth between, you know, labor politics having more power versus capital politics having more power. And so currently we've been very much on the side of capital. And because, you know, labor's been, you know, damaged by, for example, offshoring and automation, it very much reduced their kind of bargaining power. And so we're very, very far on the capital side. And the risk is that, you know, you can push things back towards the labor side, and mm-hmm. that could be, you know, basically you change different segments of the population about how well they do. And mm-hmm. so generally when you have more labor power, it's good for wages, but it also pushes down generally asset prices. And mm-hmm. so when it comes to navigating a portfolio, it helps to kind of kind of focus on those trends. And mm-hmm. one of the things we've seen, if there's a big difference between now and the 1940s, is that in many ways the United States looks more like the United Kingdom did in the 1940s, in the sense mm-hmm. that back in the 40s, the United States was, you know, we were a major creditor nation.
Yes.
That we owned more foreign assets than foreigners owned of our assets,
right.
And we were an exporter. And so basically, you know, at the time, we were kind of the China of the time. We were an emerging market that grew up into a powerhouse. And then we were selling things, say, for cheaper than the United Kingdom could. And we basically were rising power. And so now we look more like the UK in the sense mm-hmm. that, you know, we're running trade deficits. We are a net debtor nation, meaning that foreigners mm-hmm. own more U.S. assets than Americans own of foreign assets. And so basically, you know, most metrics look a lot like the 1940s, with the exception that we're also going through it with a trade deficit and mm-hmm. as a debtor nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly played a role in wealth concentration because, for example, you actually see somewhat lower wealth concentration in Japan or Europe than you do in the United States now. And that's in a large part because we've exported a large portion of our manufacturing base mm-hmm. and other types of blue-collar jobs at a faster rate than most of those other developed countries have. And so we've really kind of you know, made our economy quite top heavy in terms of those that do well versus, you know, really kind of, you know, accelerating the shift away from blue collar jobs. And mm-hmm. that's you know, partially been responsible for hollowing out the middle class mm-hmm. at a faster rate than you see in some of these other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. But I have to wonder, Lynn, you know, with the transfer payments, the stimulus money going out, the thousands of dollars to millions of investors, I mean, to millions of American lower paid people with lower paid jobs, I have to wonder if the threat of sort of some wage inflation might not be brewing, because, you know, you're hearing reports all around the country with the stimulus checks. People are saying, well, why should I go back to work when I actually make more by not working, or slightly more, or maybe not quite as much, but I don't have to work and I can use my time to do some other things. So there's a lot of, you know, restaurants and smaller, you know, smaller businesses that are having a real tough time finding labor. And I have to wonder if that's not going to force wages up. You know, you can try to mandate minimum wages and so forth, but this might be another way of doing it, just to the extent Mr. Biden is able to do it, to keep sending trillions of dollars to individuals to sit on the couch. Well, to get them to come back to work, you're going to have to bid up the wages, right?
I think we are seeing that to some extent, and that can put upward pressure on wages and then by extension, upward pressure on prices. Mm-hmm. And an example that I used recently was at the Chipotle stores around, you know, my area. They started to do these days where they basically had online order only days because they had to run like a tighter ship because they didn't have enough labor. And then there were a couple of days where they had to just close early because they were out of labor. Mm-hmm. So that translates into higher labor costs. So we saw, for example, Chipotle did a national campaign where they were going to start paying higher wages both to you know, the kind of the basic workers as well as the store managers. So we are seeing, and that's you know, pretty much got to trickle through to the you know, to the food prices. Uh-huh. And so I do think, you know, after a pretty long stretch of not really having a lot of wage growth, I think we are on the verge of more wage growth, in part because of these policies. But the key, you know, there are still some dates to look out for. So, for example, some of those, you know, the key unemployment benefits expire in September. And so, you know, those are unlikely to be renewed because now, of course, we have a lot of, kind of pushback against those policies because mm-hmm. of the impacts they're having on, you know, places like the restaurant industry. And so when you look out past September into maybe the fourth quarter of this year, we have to see how sticky some of those, you know, wage increases are. And so a lot of companies, for example, they've been reluctant to raise wages because they see kind of a light at the end of the tunnel for these unemployment benefits. And so instead, they try to do things like bigger sign-on bonuses, basically larger one-time payments in order to encourage workers to sign up. And so we have to see basically as we go into quarter four of this year, how much of that kind of sticks through, you know, after some of these benefits expire.
It certainly has to be a question. I wonder with regard to the dollar now, you know, there's some concerns, some large hedge fund manager whose name escapes my memory right now, was really voicing concern, I think, on CNBC last week sometime about...
That would be Stanley Druckenmiller.
Thank you. That's exactly who I was talking about. And he's really concerned about the dollar. It seems to me that if all the other countries are doing the same thing, but maybe we're being more aggressive than some of the other our trading partners in terms of printing money and doling out freebies, or maybe the Western countries were doing more of this in the past, and now it's something... I don't know. What are your thoughts? So do you see a threat for the dollar somewhere down the road as a result of what's going on now? And, you know, you mentioned that we're now where the UK was in the 40s, kind of. So we're not in a position of strength as we were in the 40s or as China is now, it would seem.
Yes, I've been dollar bearish since October 2019 when the dollar index was about 99. And so it's been one of my key themes of kind of tracking this go down and kind of pay attention to various counter rallies that happened. And so obviously in the March period of 2020, we had a curveball from the pandemic that briefly pushed up the dollar. The first couple months of this year, we had another kind of counter rally. And so I've been monitoring these counter rallies, but overall, I remain structurally dollar bearish. And there's a few reasons for that. One is that the U.S. runs structural trade deficits. Whereas our biggest trading partners, you know, China, Europe, Japan, they run more balanced trade situations. And so, you know, when we're running pretty tight monetary policy compared to the rest of the world, as we were, for example, during the period of quantitative tightening in 2018, 2019, that tends to be a more strong for the dollar. But as soon as we kind of join the rest of the world in having rather loose monetary policy, our currency tends to fall because the natural direction for it to go is down because of those mm-hmm. trade deficits. The second reason is that in 2020, in part because we have more wealth concentration and more we basically export our supply chains at a faster rate. Mm-hmm. The United States did do larger fiscal stimulus as a percentage of GDP compared to most of those other countries.
Uh-huh.
And so for example, if you look at broad money supply growth on a percentage basis year over year, the United States had something like 25% M2 growth last year, and Canada was also pretty similar. But most other European nations and Japan, theirs was more like 10 or 12% year over year. And so basically we created more money, and so it makes sense that our currency devalued by roughly that same amount. But that, of course, takes turns over time. And so, for example, during the past several months, we've seen Europe, for example, has been more aggressive with monetary policy in the sense that they're doing, faster QE and they're holding their interest rates at lower levels. But overall, if you look at, broad money supply creation as well as inflation-adjusted interest rates, by those metrics, the United States being more aggressive in terms of devaluing its currency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think before we run out of time here, I want to ask you what, given what we're just talking about now and what you're seeing, more of a 40s scenario, how is that impacting the kind of investments that you're making, Lynn? And I know that you're very generous in sharing your thoughts and what you're doing at least with your paid subscribers. And I should tell people that, this article, Fiscal Driven Inflation, and all the other, so many of your newsletter is really free. It's available. At least that part of your work is free. How is it impacting what you're buying and what you're investing in?
So generally, in some ways, I maintain an all-weather portfolio, but I tilt it in different directions based on what asset classes like to do well. And mm-hmm. so for a while now, I've had more of an inflationary tilt in the sense that I'm more tilted towards value stocks and growth stocks. I'm more tilted towards commodity stocks, precious metals, things like that. We've used allocations to Bitcoin even basically with risk management in place. Mm-hmm. And basically by having exposure to some of these more, these asset classes that in many ways benefit from currency devaluation, that's kind of benefited the portfolio. And I do think that those types of things are likely to work well through the 2020s, but it won't be in a straight line. And so there will be periods of time where you have kind of a more disinflationary cycle within an otherwise inflationary trend. And actually, if you go back to the 1940s and the 1970s, inflation was not a straight line in either of those decades. You had periods of rapid inflation,
sure,
and then you had cooling off periods. And so you can have these significant counter rallies in those other types of assets. And so mm-hmm. basically what I try to do is keep the big picture in mind in terms of the types of assets that are likely to do well in the 2020s, like value stocks, precious metals, commodities, things like that, while also kind of paying attention to this more rate of change things to see, when there are times where you might want a little bit more cash or growth stocks in the portfolio as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, with more specific information and what you're buying and so forth, you do share that with your subscribers, don't you?
Yeah, basically, my free newsletter comes out every 6 weeks. We do reveal a lot of portfolio positions, but then the premium service comes out more regularly and has more portfolios that people can use, maybe to add that to their own mm-hmm. their own investment style.
Sure, and I should mention that your premium is very reasonably priced. I would suggest that everyone listening to this show could certainly afford it. So it's not like you're getting stingy with your. You're very kind to make it available at a price that most people can afford. A minute left. I wondered if you could take 30 seconds to just comment real quickly on the repo market. Maybe that's unkind to ask you that, but we're seeing more action in the repo and I think the reverse repo market. Is it anything we should be keeping our eyes on?
I'm keeping my eye on it. I covered it in my last report, but essentially what we're seeing is the opposite of September 2019 when we had the repo rate spike. So mm-hmm. that was a situation of too many T-bills and not enough reserves, whereas right now the issue is that there's actually too much reserves in the system, and so banks are basically spilling that over into reverse repos. And it's actually – we had kind of a similar thing happen back in 2014, 2015.
Okay. All right. Well, people want to really understand this stuff. They should sign up for your letter and get on your website, which, again, is lynnalden.com, I believe. All right? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Lynn, for being with us. Always great to have you, and thank you. Folks, that is it. You bet. Thanks. That's it for this week, folks. Next week I'm going to have David Rosenberg with me. And Dr. Quentin Henning will update us on some of his. Well, he's going to talk about the silver-rich polymetallic project in Bolivia. That's really, I think, a very exciting story. So, I hope that you'll join me next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.